Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am joined today by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent. Right, so it's just you and me today. So we can talk a lot about companies. Shame Algie's not here because the cover feature is also about companies. It's quite good.
I think Algie did a really good feature this week.
Yeah, it's about spotting red flags. It's really drawing on the work of a number of guys who are involved in either the short selling industry or forensic accounting, one of whom you know, I think.
Tim Steer.
Not Tim, you know Tim Steer as well, who's the fund manager, whose book we refer to, which is called
The Signs Were There. Yeah, which is a very good book, actually.
And Steve Clapham, yeah, who I think you know, don't you?
From a long time ago. Steve Clapham and I used to be transport analysts in the early 2000s.
That was a place to learn how to spot the danger signs. We spoke about that quite recently.
It's actually a very, very good hunting ground for things going on, shall we say.
Indeed. And that's what the feature is about. It's about looking within the accounts for those kind of red flags that can help you avoid horrible situations like Carillion, for example, or Patisserie Valerie, or whatever it might be. It's a very long feature. It's very good. But Algie's not here to talk about it, so I urge you to go away and read that one yourselves. Let's get on to the business of companies, Phil. What have you been talking about this week in your column?
Well, I've been looking at the subject of high margin companies, extremely profitable companies.
Great things, you would imagine.
Yeah, and it's like, it's the kind of thing, it's very much in vogue. People looking for very high quality businesses, very profitable businesses.
Is margin, of you know, generally a proxy for quality then?
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, you've got to try and understand how a company makes its margin. I mean, water companies make very high profit margins.
Not exactly quality.
Yeah, exactly, because they need to earn that high margin so they've got enough money to pay for all the investment.
Mm.
So you have to be a little bit careful by assuming that high margin is an automatic sign of high quality. But for non-regulated, non-utility type businesses, it can be, and quite often is. But what I've decided to do is look at how a company makes its margin. Why is a company making its margin? And asking the question, can it stay that way?
Mm.
Because I think we're in a very, very interesting time in business now, that we've have the companies like Amazon that look at companies with very, very high profit margin saying, I'm going to have a slice of that. And if you've got the right business model, I think there are businesses out there that are actually quite vulnerable. And what I'm going to talk about is businesses that have got very high profit margins, but also sell lots of stuff, or in jargon terms, they are high volume businesses.
Mm.
So you sell a lot of stuff at very high profit margins and you make a lot of money. And that gives the potential opportunity for someone to say, I'll accept a little bit or a lot less profit margin, but still sell a lot and still do okay.
It's interesting that you start with that observation, because actually this is a good opportunity to introduce the second feature, which is the latest instalment of the IC Book Club, written by Tom Dines. He's looked at Intel.
Yeah.
And a book written by its founder, a guy called Andrew Grove, called Only the Paranoid Survive. And actually, they had exactly that situation. They were a memory chip manufacturer, and they were making really good margins. And Japanese manufacturers saw that market and said, we'll have some of that,
yeah,
and we'll take a little bit less money.
Yeah.
And the book is about how Intel responded to that. And actually, Tom refers to Bunzl, which is a more recent example, whose shares took a massive dive when there were rumours that Amazon was going to have a crack at that market. It distributes, you know, sundries, office sundries, catering sundries, something that Amazon, with its big distribution network, could easily do. So, yeah, the sensitivity to that threat is quite large. And it has happened before, as the Intel example talks about.
Yeah, and it gets you thinking. You know, you can look back at businesses, and you can look at the history of businesses and think, oh, this looks great. You know, it's had a high margin for a long period of time. It must have got something that can keep the competition from eating its lunch, and therefore it'll stay that way.
Well, you would have thought in the case of memory chip manufacturer, quite specialist.
Yeah.
How can anyone easily get into this? Well, they can.
Yeah. And this is it. Businesses are dynamic, and the industries they work in are dynamic. They change a lot, or can change a lot. And which is why, you know, if you blindly sort of buy into a high margin business and think that you can forget about it, I don't think you can. You've got to keep your eye on these things.
There's a really good example that you mentioned in the feature in your column.
Yeah.
And which has also been in the news this week, which
today.
Is today, which is Dignity.
Yeah. Now Dignity is a great example. I mean, it has a regular flow of business.
Yeah.
You know,
sadly,
very predictable regular flow of business. Arguably, you could classify this as a pretty high volume business.
Yeah, there is a certain amount of death rate in the UK every year.
Yeah, yeah, and it has charged very, very high prices, and
that served it well for a very long time. This was a stock market darling. The shares did wonderfully well for a very, very long time.
If you looked at the characteristics of this business, maybe even 2 years ago, superficially, you look at it and say, look, yeah, I understand this business. It's regular. It's predictable. It's high profit margin, good cash flow, good returns. I'll stick that away and forget about it.
And it was also, I guess, you know, funerals are not something that you would expect people to be price sensitive about necessarily. You don't want to be scrimping. You don't want to be, or seen to be scrimping at that point.
And also, you've got people in a frame of mind where they have got more important things to think about than getting value for money out of the funeral director.
So what could go wrong?
Someone comes along and says, we'll do it for less. And that is exactly what has happened. 18 months ago, Dignity was making, you know, well over 30% profit margin. And I remember doing a bit of work on this a few years ago, and you could get this number. If you were diligent enough, you could look in the accounts and just work out the revenue per funeral. And it was going up 5, 6% per year. Every year. And this is what was keeping the profits high. And then someone's come along and said, okay, let's look at the basics of funerals. We can actually, it's not like a crematorium where you actually need the land and the assets.
Doesn't Dignity own a lot of crematoria?
It does, yeah.
And that was a big part of its strategy, is from when I was looking at it a while back, like consolidating.
Yeah, and they are hard to compete against. But the funeral side, there's a lot less upfront investment needed. It's not regulated yet. And you have the internet, and you have an ability to come in and offer very simple funerals for a lot less. And this is now eating Dignity's lunch, and it's having to respond by cutting its prices. And we've seen the margin come off a couple of weeks ago, I think, when they reported their figures, from about 32 to 25. It's probably going to go to 20 this year. You know, even at 20% profit margin, you could say this is still too much.
Mm.
And I think this business could start going down a long way because, again, sorry for the jargon, the barriers or the perceived barriers, the economic moat that people like to talk about has been breached, and the water is flooding in. And this business is, I think this business has got a lot of problems. Government's come out this morning, the Competition and Markets Authority.
Aquango.
Yeah. And has come out and, you know, in a roundabout way has said, these funeral companies are ripping customers off. And it's very, very hard to disagree with that.
Mm.
You know, you look at, you know, the sort of $4,000 for a funeral. For doing what? And it's like, I know there's been a few articles in some of the papers, some of the weekend papers over the last few years, and some shocking stories about, you know, they come in and say, oh, do you want a few extras? And, you know, you throw some flowers in, it's like, you know, 500 quid for some flowers, or 120 quid to print out some hymn sheets. And you know, I think these companies have got big problems now. This really is a utility earning Apple-like profit margins. And I think we're not the last of this. I think this is gonna unravel, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's what have the shares done? I haven't looked at the share price, but I can't imagine it's responded well.
No. I mean, this is something that's been expected. You know, the CMA came out last year and said they were going to look into this, and they were going to come back this year and update people what they're thinking. So this is already, a lot of this is priced in terms of they are going to say this. They are going to say that funeral companies are charging too much, and Dignity is trying to cut its prices to try and make itself look more reasonable. But I think there's a long way to go. The big problem with Dignity, of course, is it's got a lot of debt. It's been financed with debt.
To consolidate, as we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, but also because I think it believed, up until very recently, that it had a very stable and predictable profit stream.
Like an annuity-like business.
Yeah, which could support a high level of debt. Let's see. This is not a company I'd want to go near.
Dignity, the example of what can go wrong with a high margin business. Let's talk about something that's perhaps a little bit more sustainable. Is there such a thing? I know you've identified some companies in your piece that have high margins that look okay for now, but I think your general view is keep an eye out on these companies. Yeah, but let's talk about Rightmove, for example.
Yeah, I mean, Rightmove, you've got to a situation. I mean, that I don't know a more profitable business on the stock exchange than Rightmove. And there are an increasing number of grumpy customers of Rightmove.
But they're estate agents.
Yeah.
Grumpy estate agents.
Grumpy estate agents who are handing over £1,000 a month to Rightmove, which is probably more than some of them are paying on rent for their offices.
We have talked about this before, because previously, though, they would have been handing over £1,000 a month to the local newspaper.
Yeah, but they were always... They had a relationship with the local newspaper where they could always cut themselves a deal.
Yeah. And Rightmove, non-negotiable.
Seems that way.
Yeah.
But you've got, you know, this is something that, you know, it might be right that Rightmove is so deeply entrenched with such big brand power that nothing can, you know, the agents think, well, really, can we really dump this company? On the market,
it's an AIM business that was essentially created from a consortium of estate agencies.
Yeah, it used to be called, you know, Agents Mutual. So it was a bunch of agents getting together and saying, look, we don't like the power of Rightmove. We're going to try and do this ourselves.
It hasn't really worked, though.
Not yet. I mean, they have been very aggressive in terms of signing up agents, basically for next to nothing. And seeing if they can do the same job.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound like a very sustainable business model. Hey, we'll give you this for literally no margin.
You know, Rightmove's making 75 pence in the pound, 75% profit margin.
So there's a lot of space to be eaten into.
Yeah, there's a lot of scope to undercut this. And it's not done so yet. But again, just mind your eye on here. You know, the capital invested in Rightmove is 25 million quid. For a business that's got market cap of, what, billions?
Mm. What is the market cap?
I don't know. I can't remember.
You haven't written it down, Phil?
No, I haven't written it down. It's big.
Yeah.
And it is a kind of business to think, well, if it's only 25 million, you know, it's an IT system and some marketing people and a website.
It's a dot-com dream.
And
it's a dot-com dream.
And it's, you know, there's analytics and stuff in there. I'm not saying it doesn't do things that aren't useful, but... You know, on the market, I think a lot of people think that Rightmove is going to win this. I don't think anybody thinks at the moment that Rightmove is going to lose this battle. But
Google tried to have a crack at
Facebook,
this market.
Facebook as well. Facebook have actually moved into are sort of moving into lettings advertising.
Hmm. But then Craigslist is in lettings advertising. I mean,
it may be that
And that's a business also that's becoming less profitable for estate agency groups anyway, given changes to the fees they're allowed to charge.
Yeah, but it still keeps them afloat.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, you know, let's, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, you and I could have been sitting here talking about Dignity and saying that Dignity was bulletproof. And this is the kind of theme that I'm trying to get across in the article, is that you look at these businesses, they are lauded by many investors as being fantastic, highly profitable, high quality, robust, defensive businesses. But just what I'm saying is just have a think about this, because they're earning a lot of money, and a lot of them are earning money because they're charging their customers a lot of money for the service.
Should we talk about Hargreaves Lansdown? So I mean, this is a very good stock.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a very good company. It's done amazing things for the private investor community. A lot of our listeners, a lot of our readership will use Hargreaves Lansdown as their broker, their platform.
Yeah.
What could go wrong?
Two things I think could go wrong with this is that they are making a huge amount of money from the platform fees. Which, for those of you who don't know what platform fee is, it is the fee levied by the platform provider, Hargreaves Lansdowne, for you to keep your investment with them. And they are charging 0.45% for the first £250,000 on money that's been put in funds. Used to be known as unit trusts. If you put your money in shares, investment trusts, ETFs, you're paying a flat fee and you might pay £200 tops a year. If you've got £1 million in shares, ETFs and investment trusts, you're paying £200. If you're in open-ended funds, you're paying £3,000 or £4,000. And what does Hargreaves Lansdowne push to its customers week in, week out? Funds. And the government, again, the competition, they're looking at this market.
Well, there's been some rulings recently around
on switching
fees.
Transfer
fees, yeah, exit
yeah,
fees.
Which
I think we've covered in the magazine, actually, in the PF section.
Yeah, I am really, really against platform fees on open-ended funds. I struggle to see how they are justified at all in terms of what the company does. What extra cost does the company, the platform, and this is not just Hargreaves Lansdowne, this is others, what extra cost does the platform incur on top of looking after shares, investment trusts and ETFs that justify this big pricing differential? You know, it's a classic example of price discrimination, that if you want to buy an ETF, your fee's next to nothing. But if I want to put some money in a managed fund, I'm putting a lot of money in, I'm actually potentially handing over a significant chunk of money every year to the platform provider. For what? You know, we had this retail distribution review a few years ago, which outlawed trail commission. And it seems to me that trail commission, which again was a lot of platform providers pocketing money for advice, which they never given, so it's free money, has been replaced by platform fees. And I think it's not good value for money. It's not acting in the customer's interest.
So Hargreaves has a pretty significant market share, yep, of the retail investment markets.
Yeah.
Other companies are becoming more aggressive and trying to enter this space. Yeah, you've got AJ Bell, who floated recently,
yeah, yeah,
but there are some other smaller brokers like Interactive Investor.
Yeah, who are
flat
fee. You know, Interactive Investor are flat fee. They have a trading fee on there as well. So they are...
It's a disruptive approach then.
It is a disruptive approach. Hargreaves is actually protecting itself because it is extremely good at looking after its customers.
Its customers do like... I mean, customer service, you know, in terms of the customer service surveys, always comes out on top.
It's brilliant. And, you know, they will quite rightly argue back, saying, look, got to pay for this. My view, and whether it becomes somebody else's view more powerful than me, is that that's fine. You know, you've got to pay for that. But is it right for you to discriminate on charging between different investment instruments? That's what I struggle with.
Do you think this possibly becomes a regulatory issue at some point in the future?
I do. I mean, switching fees are unfair. Transfer fees are unfair. You know, the cost incurred, you know, clearly someone's looked at that and saying, look, you know, these fees don't seem right. But the real elephant in the room here is platform fees on managed funds. I think, you know, the Hargreaves is one of the highest, 0.45. AJ Bell, a 0.25. If you are, you know, I'm sure there are people listening to this podcast who have built up significant funds over the years in their SIPs and their ISAs, and they are handing over a lot of money to platforms, not just Hargreaves Lansdown, but other platforms who are charging this percentage of value. And they might be happy with that because they think that the funds that they've invested have done quite well and it might not be a problem for them. My view is that I don't think the platform providers have ever come out and justified to their customer base why, if you buy one investment, it's a nominal fee, but if you buy a managed fund, they can make a lot of money out of it. And I think they are. I'm going to say I think they're a rip-off.
That's pretty strong, Phil.
Yeah, I think they're a rip-off. I think they treating different investments differently, different charges. I don't think that's right.
I'd love to hear more on this. I mean, I'm sure maybe someone from the platforms will respond to this podcast. I'd like to hear a justification.
I'm sure they will not like me uttering the words that I have uttered. I stand by it because I want them to come out and I want them to say why are their customers paying this fee? Because I can't see any justification for it.
All right. Well, let's see what we hear then. Let's talk about one more company that's generating extremely high margins, whose products I'm pretty sure 90% of us now use. Had a big event this week. You weren't very convinced by this, Apple.
Yeah, I mean, Apple, just linking it back to the, is a classic high margin, high volume business. And it makes a lot of money because of it. And it's run into a bit of a problem that a lot of people will be aware of, that it has, over the years, become incredibly reliant for around 2/3 of its sales, possibly more of its profits, on iPhones. And it's woken up to this. We can see that people are changing their iPhones less frequently, which is not good. If you make profits by selling devices. And so Apple needs to do something different.
And that's what this big launch was all about, the things it can do beyond the iPhone.
Yeah, so it's all about selling services to its consumers. And it's made a reasonably good start. It's had the iTunes store for many years. Have Apple Music, which has gone down really well.
iTunes might have even preceded the iPhone. I think was that not an adjunct to the iPod, which I think came first?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Apple Music's been great. I mean, they've got, I think, over 50 million subscribers now,
which is kind of like a sort of Spotify streaming.
Exactly the same as Spotify, and that's doing well. And Apple's getting, you know, annual run rate of about 40 billion of sales. Off services. It's got a lot of loyal customers who will not have an Android phone if you paid them. And so they're quite sticky. They might not change their iPhones as frequently, but they're going to stick with the ecosystem of Apple.
I used to say I wouldn't have an Apple phone if you paid me, but now I wouldn't have an iPhone, an Android phone if you paid me. They're a good product.
I like Apple products. I think they... Do we overpay for them? Yes.
Yeah, of course.
But they work nice. They're simple. They don't get viruses. The ecosystem works really well. So what we've had this week is a series of new services. And I think the most interesting one, there's two interesting ones, actually. There's the TV streaming, which I'll talk about in a second. And then there's the card, Apple credit card.
Because the world needs more credit cards.
And it looks a really great deal, actually, offering 2% cash back. It's done in a partnership with Goldman Sachs, I believe.
Right.
2% cash back for all purchases, 3% cash back on Apple purchases. And this is a great way of boosting the use of Apple Pay, but also keeping people within the Apple ecosystem. I think this is a great move. I'm not sure how much money they're going to make out of it, because I imagine it'll be Goldman Sachs that'll be lending the money. And Apple might get a little bit of a fee and then give it back in terms of cash back or more.
Sounds like a branding deal.
I'm struggling to see how, you know, they're not like a mass. It's not like a MasterCard, which is all essentially a processing system. It's like an agency. You know, it's like a John Lewis credit card.
Mm.
You know, they'll get a bit of money from a transaction fee. But if you are giving 2% cash back, I don't think you're going to have much money left. But then again, given the cash on Apple's balance sheet, you could almost think it looks like a bank anyway.
Maybe it's a way of promoting the Apple Pay system more
it
than
is.
Anything
it
else.
It is. I think, actually, just to digress,
the sector focus this week is following up, actually, on what we talked about last week about the payments world, because there's been some big deals going on there. Payment is a big thing.
Yeah.
So, digital payments, you can see how a cashback-led credit card could be a loss leader for growing
I think it's a loss leader. I might be wrong, but I need to look at it. But it seems to me like it's a loss leader, given the levels of cashback, given that they probably aren't the lenders. Goldman Sachs will be the lenders. And then the sort of transaction fee, obviously, it's probably going to be done in partnership with either MasterCard or Visa. I've heard it's MasterCard. So MasterCard will get a fee. So I don't see this as a money spinner, but I see it as a way of keeping people in the ecosystem, which is a good thing. Whether these people would have stayed anyway, who knows? But it's certainly a good way of attracting people to keep on using Apple and Apple Pay. The other one, there was a couple of other things. There was an arcade subscription, a gaming subscription.
It's gaming.
Yeah, which, why would anybody use Apple for gaming when you can use a lot better things for gaming, in my opinion?
Yeah, it's not their core strength.
There's a new subscription service, which is going to go for around $10 a month. It's got a lot of stuff on there, but whether that's going to fly, I'm not so sure, given how much revenue Apple's taking off the publishers.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the big thing was the TV streaming.
And they've been talking about some kind of TV product for a very, very long time.
Yeah, and I think this was a real disappointment. They had a lot of high profile. They had Steven Spielberg, who apparently was saying that nothing on Netflix should be up for an Oscar. He's then on the stage at Apple, promoting its streaming business, along with people like Jennifer Aniston and Oprah Winfrey, I think, was there. It was a big sort of loving.
It always is, though, an Apple launch.
It was
isn't
lots
it?
Of that's lots the, of lots of weeping go. And worshiping and stuff, and it was a bit cringeworthy, to be honest.
Yeah, but we're British. Yeah, you know? we don't go.
Maybe
into
that's
that sort
where
of
we're
thing.
Going wrong. Maybe that's where we, as Brits, are going wrong. I just thought, and you sort of take a step back and you look at the bare bones of this and think it's a bit thin. And yes, they're going to be an aggregator as well in terms of channels, and you can have all, but. It just thought, and the thing is as well, they didn't tell us how much it was going to cost. And you sort of come back to this and think, you look at the likes of Netflix and Amazon Prime, and you think, this was all big because of this sort of theme of cord cutting. People going away from the cable television and doing individual subscriptions direct with the content providers. And you sort of look at it now and you think, there are so many of these streaming services now. It's not just Amazon and Netflix. You've got Hulu. You've got Disney bringing one out. Mm. Time Warner are bringing one out.
Oh, you've got the terrestrial channels who have their own players.
Yeah, ESPN.
A lot of content on there.
And you add all this up and thinking, I'd be better off going back to the cable TV because they're costing such a lot of money. And I just think, are people really going to? You know, I'm sure Apple's going to probably price this at $10 a month, probably.
And they're investing what looks on the face of it like quite a substantial amount of money. Well, it's a billion, but your view is that that's quite small, really.
Yeah, I mean, Netflix is spending about $6 billion.
Every year?
Yeah.
On content?
Yeah, on its own content.
Yeah.
Not just, that's before it buys in the other content. And it just seems a bit thin. I just think, you know, it's trying to say, oh, we're going to do something different and it's going to be high quality and that kind of thing. I'm just not convinced that this is going to fly. And it's, you know, it's late to the game. And I left watching that pretty underwhelmed, actually.
Mm.
And I still think that both these things, from a money-making point of view, from, you know, the card and the streaming, I don't think it solves Apple's problem at all here. I think
what is Apple's problem?
It's too reliant on the iPhone.
Right.
It doesn't solve its problem.
What about there's talk of a car, isn't there? We're like miles away from that, aren't we?
Who makes money in cars?
Quite.
Elon Musk doesn't.
Well, that's another industry ripe for disruption, but from a very low margin base, I guess. So
yeah, it's a problem. You know, they've got a very successful business. I think they are. I don't think they're going to lose customers, as we say, but whether they can keep growing profits, I think, you know, trying to prop the share price up by buying back lots of shares could only work for so long.
Yeah, it's a quality as measured by margin. It's kind of everything you said to me suggests that this is something we should be really very, very cautious of indeed. Is there another approach? There's another company you mentioned which kind of does the exact opposite of this.
An American company.
An American company,
yeah.
Again.
Yeah, Costco. And I mean, I wrote about Amazon a few weeks ago, and I think Amazon's actually learnt a lot of lessons from Costco and copied a lot of things. And it's just...
What does Costco do?
Costco is a wholesale retailer. So what it does is that it charges a membership fee. So you can't just drive up off the street and go into Costco like you could go into Walmart. So you have to become a member of the discount club.
What is it? This in the UK, you have cash and carries.
It's
a cash and carry. Costco, but Booker is the same.
You have Macros,
which I think Booker owns, actually.
Yeah. And so you pay a membership fee. It's about $60 a year. And Costco, it sells a pretty narrow range of only about just under 4,000 different products.
Who are its customers? Shops or the general public?
Yeah, shops. Right. Shops. But, you know, you get businesses. You know, you get a lot of people running their own sort of catering businesses.
Yeah,
we'll use
yeah.
wholesalers and shops. And you get individual memberships as well. And you go in and it offers fantastic value. On a very narrow, focused buying, bit like Aldi and Lidl, actually. The secret of Aldi and Lidl is, you know, you concentrate your buying into a small number of items. Not tens of thousands, but a few, you know, low thousands rather than 50,000. Concentrate your buying power, drive the prices down, you become a source of growth for your supplier, and everybody's happy. And this has been a tremendously successful business. By offering outstanding value for money, keeping the cost lean, keeping it very much no frills. You know, it only owns 3% profit margin, but it's making 20% return on investment, which a lot of companies would absolutely kill for.
It's a sheer volume game.
Yeah,
here.
But you know, my question is, can you take this model and apply it to certain businesses which are high margin, high volume? Can someone say, okay, I'm gonna cut the prices of the high price, high margin, high volume. I'm gonna do a modest margin or a low margin. Still sell lots of stuff, and instead of making 40% return, I'll make 15%. And, you know, I've mentioned businesses in there like software companies. We've talked about, you know, Rightmove, Hargreaves Lansdowne, Dignity. And, you know, it's an article that's about getting investors just to think about where the margin comes from.
It's absolutely fascinating because it's counterintuitive.
Yeah, so and it comes down to what's the moat, what's the high margin company got that stops someone coming along and doing this?
Do you know, there's a company in the UK that, I mean, you haven't read about here, but I look at, and everyone hates it. And I look at it, I think he's got an idea here, Sports Direct International. It sort of has that feel about it. It's driving down the cost, but having such a huge, huge, you know, presence in the market that it makes a lot of money.
It's kind of lost its way, though, hasn't it?
You think so?
Yeah.
I don't know. It feels like it has because he's buying lots of things. But it seems that there's an end game there, which is just to sell lots of stuff in lots of areas incredibly cheaply.
Yeah, that's the business model.
I think it's a good model. I think Sports Direct is going to be a confound expectations, yeah. I have to say.
I think maybe. I don't know enough.
We don't. I've looked at it for years.
But this is what I think, you know, as I've said before, businesses like Dignity, you would have said, some people would have said they were bulletproof 4 or 5 years ago. And some of these businesses may well have enough. They may be so deeply entrenched with their customers that people won't switch. But
I think people would always switch for an economic imperative.
Exactly. And I think I think we've always been a value conscious world. I think we're getting a much more value conscious world.
And it's becoming an economically more difficult world.
Yeah, consumers and businesses, actually. Mm. I think what the likes of Amazon and Costco have opened the eyes to is that, you know, you can get disruptors, industry disruptors that come along. We might not know about them yet, but what I'm trying to get across is that these things can happen. And it's basically saying, if you own these businesses with high profit margins, go and have another look at them, kick the tires, and make sure that these businesses are as resilient as you probably thought they were.
I mean, it's something I kind of allude to in my editorial. Things change. Things always change.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you stick with your thinking about how a business was at a certain point and never change your view of that business, then you're going to run into trouble.
Just sort of cross-referencing to Algie's article, there's a great quote from Steve Clapham in there about saying he looks at the margins of companies relative to their peers. And he looks, you know, if he thinks that the margins look too high relative to the peers, and he references Patisserie Valerie in this.
I do remember that point. Yeah. It was great. It was a great example.
Hold on a minute. Why is this, you know, so profitable? I mean, that's a sort of different tact in terms of spotting fraud. But it's a great question to ask. You know, why will these margins stay so high? I don't want to get on too much of a downer about it. I just think...
I think it's really important to not be complacent.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the message trying to get across for people who are, you know, running their portfolios and investing in individual shares is you've got to know these businesses as well as you can.
Yeah, absolutely. And keep watching them because they change.
Yeah.
And the competitors change and the landscape changes.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks, Phil.
Okay.
Lots more in the Alpha update this week, which we haven't had a chance to discuss. House builders, they're a nice high margin business at the moment. But we don't need to go into it now. We've talked about house builders quite enough.
I think people are bored of it now.
I'm bored of house builders. Yeah, lots more in there. Lots more in the magazine. We've touched upon the cover feature and the secondary feature, which are related. Spotting red flags and also understanding how industries change and companies may think about changing with them. We talk about the sector focus, which is about payments relating to the Apple story. Lots of results this week, although results season is, thank goodness, winding down a bit now. All the usual stuff in the personal finance and funds section, which they will talk about on their podcast, including a very long investment trust column from Leonora about how to buy investment trusts through platforms at a flat fee rather than open-ended funds. And lots of news, all the usual news. What we've got in the news, Inmarsat, I think, is on the way out. We alluded to that last week. Airlines, once again, having Brexit-related troubles. A shock profit warning from Renishaw, although given what we're seeing in the global economy, perhaps not that much of a surprise. And Sports Direct, as I mentioned earlier, making its advance on Debenhams.
Trying to save its own money.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for listening. Pick up the magazine, All Good News Agents, Spotting Red Flags, How to Identify the Signs That Could Derail Your Investments, and we will be back next week. See you later.